The 57 Chevy station wagon. Long, low, and roomy, with four doors, sleek fins, lots of chrome, a two-tone paint job, and white walls. The Chevy Bel Air Townsman became the quintessential car for middle-class families living the American dream. Journalist and author Earl Swift traced the life of one 57 Chevy station wagon from its assembly at the Baltimore GM plant through a dozen owners to a sad purgatory of rust and torn upholstery to its complete restoration in Norfolk, Virginia by an outlaw motorhead. Earl Swift joins us with his autobiography and 57 years of the American dream on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Earl Swift did something I wish I had thought of. He traced the life of one 1957 Chevy station wagon from its assembly at the Baltimore GM plant through about a dozen owners to what I call the sad purgatory of rust and torn upholstery to its complete restoration in Norfolk, Virginia by an outlaw motorhead. So there's some characters in this story, too. Earl used the few records still held by the Virginia Department of Motor Vehicles, relying mostly on the memories of each owner to uncover how the car changed hands over all those decades. Along the way, he encountered the previous owners, including a doctor, a born-again Christian garbage man, and a hippie, until he arrived at the first owner, who bought the car hot off the assembly line in Baltimore. The result of all this is a book called Autobiography. Two words, autobiography, a classic car, an outlaw motorhead, who we'll talk about, dominates the story, really, and 57 Years of the American Dream by Earl Swift, our guest in this hour of Midday. Earl, nice to see you. Nice, congratulations, too, on this book.
Oh, Dan, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
You worked on this book, by my math, about 10 years, it looks like.
Close, yeah, right? Nine and change.
You were a reporter in Norfolk at the Virginian Pilot.
Yes, sir.
And that's when you first got onto this, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I had owned a lot of terrible cars in my 20s, as most of us do, a lot of us do anyway, especially in college. And I found myself, while driving those pieces of junk, wondering about the poor saps who owned them before I did and whether the cars were ever worth anything. And that kind of thinking eventually led years later to my realizing that might make a cool story to find an old car and try to rebuild the chain of possession for that vehicle and tell a bigger story through that fraternity of otherwise unconnected people who had shared that one central kind of American possession.
Mm-hmm. And the bigger story you're thinking is, well, the American car tells the American story from the 50s on.
Certainly
right?
The post-war story, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you wanted a car that had multiple owners, but you hit a gold mine with this one.
I did. I got very lucky. You know, if you had told me at the time that I'd be able to establish, it was 2004 that I started the project, and if you had told me then that I'd be able to complete the chain for a car that was 47 years old, I would not have, you know, I don't think I could have believed it.
Okay, so how did you start? How did you find this car?
I went to the classifieds in the paper and under antiques and classics, and I looked for cars that sounded interesting. And the car, I figured a car to work in the story had to meet a number of criteria. It had to be an interesting car in its own right. It had to have passed through a minimum of 7-8 owners, something like that.
Okay.
Just to have critical mass for
the story. Right.
And it had to have been through some interesting times. And so I went through the paper. I picked out a dozen, 15 cars that looked kind of interesting. I remember there was a Plymouth Satellite in there, a 65 Satellite, and a number of others, and started calling the people who were trying to sell them to ask them whether they remembered who they had bought the cars, you know, they were now trying to sell from. And right away, half of them fell off the grid. They did not recall. And of course,
did Virginia not keep records of previous owners? Was that one of the problems you had?
That was the central problem, which I did not realize when I came up with the idea for the story, was that Virginia, like many states in the pre-digital days, shredded its automotive records after a couple of title transfers. So you have no paper trail. You have to find an owner who remembers enough about the person he or she bought from that you can figure out who that seller was and then repeat the process over and over and over, going all the way back.
In looking through the classifieds, Earl Swift, did you find a 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman?
No, I did not.
Okay. Because that's the car you ended up with,
yes.
Right?
I found a number of cars, ran into brick walls with all but three after one set of phone calls. And one of the three survivors was a 1970 Olds Cutlass wagon. Not an inspiring piece of machinery.
No.
That was owned by a guy named Dave Morrison Sook of Chesapeake, Virginia, born-again Christian garbage man. And he told me on the phone that he had the entire ownership history of the car. So very excited I drove over there. And once I got there, Dave revealed that he was the fourth owner of the car, and the car had spent 20-some-odd years on a farm, not really going anywhere. So it essentially had no story to tell. So I was saying goodbye to Dave, and he said, well, you know, I do have one other car that you might be interested in. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? And he said, well, it's a 57 Chevy. And immediately I didn't think, wow, a classic. I thought, wow, 47 years old, there's no way.
There's no way it's still alive.
No way that I'll be able to trace it.
Oh, trace it, right. Yeah, because we know people collect cars, and you can find a 57 Bel Air. Lots of them, actually.
You can. Yeah. And the ones that have complete ownership histories have been owned by a handful of people, or they've always been in the hands of collectors. To find a car that was just a regular kind of family wagon from 1957 and be able to establish provenance is tough.
So what did Dave Marson Sook have? He had the 57 Chevy?
He said, look, it's over at Big Al's Mufflers getting a new exhaust. I need a ride over there. Would you give me a lift and I'll show you the car?
So he was the present owner?
He was. Okay. At that time, he was owner number 11.
Okay.
So I gave him a ride to Big Al's. There was this thrashed, sun-bleached, turquoise 57 Chevy wagon, you know, the size of the Graff Spey sitting in front of this muffler shop.
The size of the Graff Spey. And, it's a pretty big car.
It is. 16.
It's supposed to seat 8, but you could probably put 10 or 12 in there.
You could fit 9 in one version of it.
Okay. And let's take a moment here and describe a 57, before, not the one that you actually saw that day, which was in sorry shape, but a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air Townsman, a station wagon. Can you describe it for folks who, this is radio. You can find photographs of it on my Facebook page, folks, and there are photographs in Earl's book, but please.
Well, it's a car with a very recognizable face. It's got hooded headlights that give it the impression of having eyelashes. It almost has a feminine look about it, but it's got a very brawny grill bumper assembly. A lot of chrome in the front end.
A lot of chrome.
Yeah, and it's got tusks that jut from the corners of that kind of grill mouth. And a very straight belt line, you know, the line beneath the windows that runs all the way to the back and you know, from the headlights on to the rear. And that belt line forms a pair of fins in the back that don't rise like a lot of fins of the 50s. They just jut straight rearward and then come back in kind of a meat cleaver angle. And it's one of those designs that, you know, it's a bit busy. There's a lot going on there.
It's long.
It's really, the fins really kind of lengthen it to the eye, which is one thing that the designers were always aiming for. They wanted a car that looked wide, long, and low.
And that's a big windshield.
It is. It was the first curved, you know, 55 Chevy, which is essentially the same car. It's the first Chevy with a curved windshield.
Right. Lots of glass in that car.
It sits up high by today's standards. Looks crazily high. It's a kind of a battering ram to any air that happens to get in its way.
And Earl, were these cars always two-toned?
No.
Not always, because this one was.
Yes. This was a 210 model, which was there were three trim levels of Chevrolet in 1957. You had a 150, which was very bare bones, usually just one color. The 210, which was two-toned like this. And then the Bel Air, which had stainless steel inserts in some of the places where this had the two-tone paint.
All right, let's go back to 2004 again. You're with Dave Marson Sook down in Virginia, and this 57 Chevy is having a muffler job done on it?
It was getting a new exhaust.
And what did it look like?
It was cracked like a dry lake bed. It was torn asunder inside. I mean, there were no surfaces left that hadn't been worn through on the interior. It was holed through with rust. There was essentially no floor to the car. It was kind of a Flintstones mobile almost. And, you know, the one part of the roof had caved in and a past owner had made a bad plexiglass or fiberglass, rather, tried fix to it. And it had... failed to set properly, so now there was this giant dimple in the roof.
A concave?
Yeah,
concavity. Roof of fiberglass or something?
Not good looking.
Had there been birds inside this buggy?
At that point, no, but that was to come.
Okay, I'm getting ahead of the story here. Okay, so what was Dave wasn't driving it, was
Dave
he?
Dave was attempting to turn this into his daily driver, and in fact did. The exhaust was the last stage of his attempts to at least get it back on the road. And so he drove it to the place where the city kept its garbage trucks every day. I, meanwhile, figuring that I'd have no chance of being able to trace this, went back to the office, faxed DMV with the car's VIN, which I had taken off the door.
The VIN, the vehicle identification number.
Yes, sir. It's birth certificate, basically. And a couple days later, a manila envelope shows up in the mail, and there are two title transfers sent to me from DMV inside, redacted of anything useful. Someone has taken a black marker and crossed out the names and addresses.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Just what a reporter needs.
Yeah, it was frustrating for a moment, but then I saw that they had used a bad marker to make the redaction, and if I held the papers up to the light, I could see through the ink and see two names. So I got two names that way. Of course, I had Dave's name. He remembered who he had bought it from. So now I had four names of past owners, and from those four, was able to piece together, often by blind luck as much as shoe leather, the other seven owners.
Okay.
Of the car.
Do you mind? Could we go back to the beginning?
Sure.
And then go from there? And then we'll end up with our outlaw Motorhead, who becomes a major character in the story you tell. Earl Swift is our guest in this hour of midday. Autobiography, his book, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. Earl, as a reporter at the Virginian Pilot, wanted to trace the history of this car. And he succeeded. And the story actually begins in Baltimore.
It does. The body of the car was built in Cleveland, as all Chevy station wagons were that year, and was then put on a railroad car to Baltimore, where it was assembled at the Chevy plant. And it rolled out of here on another train bound for Colonial Chevrolet in Norfolk, Virginia, where in the late summer, it looks like it was built on Monday, July 15th, 1957 in Baltimore, by the way. And early afternoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got that detailed a record.
Well, you can look at the production numbers for each plant and figure out what day it happened. And then judging by the number of cars produced that day, kind of break the work, you know, the two-shift work day down and
right.
figure out when it came out.
Right. And you know, that GM plant later produced, many decades later, produced Astro Vans,
yeah.
right? So I was thinking about this because this car, the Bel Air Townsman, is sort of the minivan of its time,
yeah.
right? It was a station wagon with lots of room for kids and groceries and dogs.
It was. It was the SUV of its day, really, in terms of status symbol. It advertised to everybody who saw it that you had achieved a piece of the American dream. You were living the suburban good life.
Yeah.
Whether or not that was true.
And you were having babies.
That's the image you were putting
right?
out there.
This yeah. was the baby boom.
You
this
bet.
Is the height of the baby boom, the 1950s. Eisenhower was in the White House. Things are pretty good in the United States in the economy, right?
Yeah, yeah. There was a little bit of a recession in 58. But yeah, 57 was fat times.
Okay. So the car comes out of Baltimore and ends up at, what did you say, Colonial Chevrolet?
Colonial Chevrolet at the corner of Olney Road and Bush Street in downtown Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay.
Where a 60-year-old civilian boilermaker for the Navy named Nicholas Thornhill bought it a couple of weeks later.
Okay. What do you know about Mr. Thornhill? Does he have a family? He needs a car this size.
He does. He's a widower and a divorcee and with three kids. And an avid gardener, and he had been driving a late 40s Chevy for 10 plus years, and he needed a larger vehicle to haul around his shovels and his soils and his plants. So, after
so he was the first owner.
He was, and did something that very few people who owned new cars in 1957 did, which was he kept it for 15 years. You know, you were expected pretty much to turn over a car in 3-4 years back then.
Yeah, and, I remember those days.
And that dovetailed yeah. with the state of technology, too, because cars, yeah. you know, they didn't last.
Oh, but he kept his for 15 years.
He nursed it along, built a freestanding garage in his backyard for it, specifically for the car, just lavished it with TLC.
And do you know what Nicholas paid for it, Mr. Thornhill?
$2,456.
Let me get that down.
This
is brand new, right off the showroom floor, right?
Yes, $2,456. $2,456. And not including the tube radio and a heater, which he paid extra for.
Did a tube radio?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. Let me ask you this. Did they even rate cars for mileage back then? Did anyone care about that?
I've never seen any MPG figures for.
I can't imagine they even cared about it. We're thinking about it then, right? Oh, what was gasoline in 1957? Look that up. Will you? Somebody in the control
29
room.
29 cents or something like that?
You're saying 29?
I'm guessing.
I'm going to say 22 cents a gallon for regular.
Okay.
I'm guessing. Listen, can we take some phone calls here?
Sure.
This is a live talk show at WYPR. This is the midday show. Dan Rodericks is here with Earl Swift, whose book is Autobiography, the story of a 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman, a station wagon. And it's 13 owners, ended up being 13 owners. You stumbled in at the 11th owner.
Right.
And then there were two more after that.
There were.
So we'll get to that. We'll do the whole thing, Earl. So if you want to call us, maybe you were a member of a family that had one of these cars once upon a time. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Please join in. If you have questions for Earl, please feel free to ask him a question. Our toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309. The midday email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Earl Swift is with us, author and journalist. His writing for Norfolk's Virginian Pilot, the newspaper there, was nominated 5 times for a Pulitzer Prize. He's currently a residential fellow of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Now, this book, this is what, your third or fourth book?
Fifth.
Your fifth book, excuse me. The Big Roads, The Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers Who Created the American Superhighways. That's from a few years ago. You also had another book on Tangier, right?
Yeah, it was
The Watermen of Tangier Sound?
Collection of stories, and the title piece was about Tangier Island and the community there.
And you have this local connection here with this story now, autobiography, of course. The first owner was in Virginia,
right?
Because the car came out of the car dealership in Virginia after having been assembled in Baltimore in July 57?
Yes, sir.
Right.
July 15th.
Okay. So Nicholas Thornhill was the first owner, but he loved this thing. He had it for 15 years, which brings us up to 1972.
And the car would make forays out of town, took the kids to their colleges in Georgia and North Carolina and such, and grandkids, but it always stayed in Hampton Roads. And then Nicholas died, and the car was inherited by his grandson, Bruce Thornhill Jr., who was a veterinarian and drove it to his practice every day, where it fell under the admiring gaze of one of his clients, a guy who owned a poodle named Sid Pollard Jr. And Sid,
you just identified him as a guy who owned a poodle. Is that relevant and important?
Well, he was going to the vet. That's how he saw.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
I don't identify people that just randomly.
No, I like the detail. I like the details, Earl. Thank you. So the guy owns a poodle, and he needed a bigger car, or what?
Well, he just loved the styling. We're talking. By this time, it's the early 70s, and American Graffiti has come out. The cars of the 50s, which never got really much respect in the 60s, 57 Chevy was not an instant classic, suddenly have come into vogue. And Sid Pollard is enraptured by the Doc's big 57 wagon.
And who is Sid? What did he do for a living besides owning a poodle? What do we know about him?
Sid was a heating and air conditioning specialist for the Navy, another civilian who worked at the Norfolk Naval Shipyard. And he had been married a couple of times at that point and had a couple of kids and decided, or I guess he had no kids at that point. He had kids shortly after getting the car and managed to convince the Doc to sell it to him and became its happy owner for 7-8 years.
Okay, so it went from Nicholas Thornhill, the original owner, to Bruce Thornhill, grandson?
Grandson.
Grandson of Nicholas Thornhill, Bruce Thornhill, the veterinarian. Sold it to Sidney Pollard, who just admired the vehicle. And what was, do you know what the sale price was? Sometime in the 70s.
Not off the top of my head. It's in the book.
It's in the book.
I think it's $300. But
okay. Now, here's a question. By then, what kind of maintenance did the vehicle need? Do you remember talking to any of these owners in this period, Sid Pollard or Bruce Thornhill, about what the vehicle needed?
Well, Sid's a motorhead, a guy who really knows his way around engines, had been turning a wrench on every... He owned a bunch of Renaults, and if you've owned Renaults, you know, you learn a lot more about a car that's bad than you do about a good one, and so he knew a lot about cars. And he essentially restored the car in the early, mid-70s. I know it had a burn exhaust valve. He replaced that. That was really the only engine issue it had. And he had a little bit of body work done, had it repainted by a buddy of his.
So now this car had so many owners, but here's Sid who really loved the car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? Why did Sid let it go?
Sid had kids and realized as America was getting more safety conscious with its vehicles and with highway deaths, that the 57 Chevy made very few concessions to vehicle safety. It had no padding, essentially, inside it whatsoever. No seat belts.
Lots of glass.
Lots of heavy gauge steel, but that steel was built on a frame, bolted to a frame that did not yield in a wreck. So it transferred all impacts through its passengers instead of absorbing them. No crumple zones at all in a 57 Chevy. It would fold up in disastrous ways, unexpected ways. And so he reluctantly decided he would have to sell.
Okay, we'll get to the next owner in a moment. Earl Swift is with us, his book Autobiography about the 57. Are you going to look up the price?
No, I'm going to look up some other stuff real quick.
I have the list of everybody who owned it here right in front of me, so don't worry. I can walk you through it. I can jog your memory. I know it's a lot to remember, even if you wrote the book. You're forgiven if you can't remember every owner, 13 owners of a 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman, a station wagon that started its life in Baltimore in the assembly line down at the old General Motors plant. But, you know, I look at this picture of this station wagon, and I can see it loaded with kids. I see it at a drive-in movie. I see it at Benji's and probably turned around, backed up so that the kids could look out the back and watch the movie. What did this thing look like? What did the Bel Air look like from the rear? How did the rear open?
Well, the glass on the rear flipped up. It folded up. And
was that an innovation?
Tailgate?
For 1957? No.
It had been happening. It mighty handy. You get a much bigger load into it that way.
Right.
And it opened all the way up. I mean, the glass didn't just come up parallel to the roof. It kept going.
Okay. So the glass top opened up, and then the tail went down, right?
Right.
And kids sat on there and watched a drive-in movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
By the way, our crack staff here at WYPR did a little checking, and the best they can come up with is 30 cents.
Oh!
About 30 cents. So you're closer than I was.
We were playing the
prices
right.
Here's Sam in Baltimore. Let's take a couple of calls while we're talking to Earl Swift about his book today. Oh, Sam said he had a 57 Bel Air, and he said before he left that he remembered paying 36 cents a gallon. But I wonder what year it was. Here's Norm in Easton on the Eastern Shore. Norm, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Dan. Great show. And hello, Earl.
Hey, how are you doing?
A question about this wagon you had. Was it an auto transmission?
Yes, Powerglide.
Okay. Now, are you familiar? My dad had a 210 sedan, and the registration on the gear shift was, in its column, park, neutral, drive, low, and reverse. One time I was cruising down to Oxford, and I wanted to hot rod around a little, and I dropped it from drive to low to get some extra kick, and the damn thing went into reverse.
Ooh.
I dropped it too low.
Mm.
That thick thing locked up, spun around the middle of the road. Fortunately, there weren't any cars coming, and I thought, wow, I dropped the transmission on the ground, stalled out, you know. I put it in neutral.
And you, but you, Norm, you had a sedan, you said?
This was a sedan.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
My dad's.
Okay. Can I ask you something? You just mentioned Powerglide transmission.
Yes, sir.
Did that mean anything, or was this just a gimmick from General Motors?
No, it was the bulletproof automatic transmission that was used in Chevys, of the mid-50s. That year, they introduced a new automatic transmission called Turboglide, which you could get for as an option. It was a 3-speed instead of a 2-speed, but you know, it just did not provide the kind of reliability of the Powerglide
Okay.
Paraglide did.
And thank you. Norm referred to the Prindle, the park reverse neutral drive low. He had it as park neutral drive low reverse. I always thought it was Prindle PR first.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just guessing. That's what I'm going by memory. And I remember a push button transmission in a car that my family owned in 1960, I guess. What about the Bel Air? It had a stick on the
Yeah, it was on the tree.
On the tree. Okay. All right, let's go back to our chronology here of ownership, Earl. By the way, most of the people, the 13 people who own this car, are most of them alive still?
All of them but two.
All but two.
Nicholas Thornhill died, as we discussed, in the early 70s, and a later owner. We'll get to her.
Okay. So we went from the Thornhills, the original owner and grandson, to Sydney. Now to Frank DeSimone, and he comes along, and Sydney has to sell the thing. He sold it in 1983, according to my notes.
Yeah, sure did. Frank was the guy who had done the paint job on the car when Sydney restored it back in the mid-70s. And he was over at Sydney's one night, and they were talking. The subject came around to the Chevy, and Frank allowed as to how he had always liked the car. And Sydney said, well, you interested in buying it? And before the evening was over, Frank was walking out with the car.
Okay. And how long did Frank have it?
Very, very briefly. He owned an auto body shop in Portsmouth, Virginia, and parked it on the lot, would fiddle with it when he didn't have other jobs, but he had a lot of other jobs. And one of the guys who worked for him had a buddy who would drop by the lot now and then. And that buddy, a guy named Pikett Savage, and his wife, Debbie.
Pikett?
Pikett, P-I-C-O-T.
Okay, that's his first name.
That's...
okay.
Yeah.
Picot, if you're doing the French. Okay.
In Virginia, it's Pikett. And Pikett and Debbie fell in love with this thing sitting on the lot, talked to Frank about it. Frank agreed to sell it to them at a considerable markup from the amount that he paid Sid Pollard for it. And off the car went to their home in Suffolk, Virginia.
Okay. My notes indicate that Frank had some legal problems, too.
Many, many years later.
Oh, many years later?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought we were sort of tracking American history here, so I thought I'd bring that up. It's now 1984, and the Savages have the car. At some point here, this 57 Chevy becomes a collector's item rather than something that's useful to people?
Not yet. It's,
not yet.
It's still a daily driver. Everybody who's owned it so far needs a car. You know, it's not. It has not yet become an accessory. It's not a weekend plaything.
Are you surprised at that? Because I was wondering. That's what I wanted to ask you. Were people buying this because they liked having a classic car that they could take out for a drive once in a while on a weekend on a summer day, or were they still buying it because they needed a car?
I think they needed a car and they liked this one because it looked great. You know, it made a statement wherever it went. At this point, you know, the car is 25 years old. It's becoming a rarity on the roads. This was a ubiquitous vehicle when it, you know, there were 128,000 of them produced just to the station wagon model, the four-door wagon. And so it was the background kind of chatter for an entire generation. Wherever you looked, you saw a 57 Chevy. Now in the early to mid-80s, it's acquiring a distinction that it has not had until this time. So the people who are buying it, so far they've all needed a car, but you know, this thing, when it arrives, you know it.
You know, it's interesting to think about is in 57, when this car sold, it was probably the family car. It was probably the only car that a family owned.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, isn't that likely? Because by the time you get to the 80s, now families have at least, what, two cars,
the
right?
Shift,
or
the
1.78 cars or something like that, right?
Yeah, the shift towards the majority of households having two cars we're well on the way.
Right. More women have gone to work. There's a need for two cars in families, right?
Yeah.
So that's changed. I mean, the suburbanization of America is continuing.
Yeah.
It's still growing in that regard. Can I ask you about the body of this car? I'm curious about this. After 25 years, do the math for me, Earl. 1957 to 1984 is
27
years. So how's the body holding up on this 57 Chevy?
Well, luckily it's been owned to this point by Sid Pollard and his body, you know, auto body expert.
Okay.
You know. So it's in good shape. It's looking good.
There's no Serious rust underbody?
Maybe a little floret here and there,
okay.
But nothing major at all. I mean, and part of that is, you know, cars of the 50s, even if they had a really good paint job, they had just junk for undercoating. And, you know, paint technology wasn't what it is today.
And what about the mileage on the car? Not gas mileage. I mean, the odometer reading. Do you know, did you track that?
The car has now flipped into six figures. So it's over 100,000, which is a rarity for a car this old.
In 1984.
Well, a rarity for a 1957 Chevy.
Yeah.
But by the mid-80s, it's that's now right. in six figures.
Okay.
And so the Savages have it in Suffolk, and Debbie Savage drives it every day to the nursery at which she works. And the nursery is in Portsmouth, back over by Sid Pollard's house. And it's her daily driver. She drives it for a couple of years. And it becomes the subject of longing from a coworker of hers, a hippie chick named Mary Ricketts.
Want to pick up at Mary Ricketts after this next break? It's time for a break. Are you okay with that?
I'm fine with that.
All right, we'll go to owner number six, Mary Elizabeth Byram Ricketts, when we get back. Our guest in this hour of the show is Earl Swift. His book is Autobiography. It's what it says. It's a biography of an automobile, a 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman station wagon that's still around. It didn't end up in the junkyard. Well, you hear the whole story, more of the story, when we get back. And if you were in a family that had one of these cars, if you have a memory you want to share with us, please give us a ring. 410-662-8780. Our guest, Earl Swift, will be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library tonight.
Yes, sir.
And I'll tell you about that when we get back, too. A short break. Yeah, I mentioned that Earl Swift, the author of Autobiography, is going to be at the Pratt Library tonight. What time are you supposed to be there?
6:30.
6:30 at the Central Branch, downtown Baltimore.
Yes,
you been there yet?
I have not.
Beautiful place. What are you driving these days?
I'm driving a Camry.
A Camry? What year?
It's an 07, with a V6.
You know, there are many ways in which you can feel old, you know, when you realize you've been around for a while. Right? One of the ways is to see antique tags or license plates on a car that you remember driving or being a passenger in.
You bet.
A friend of mine had a Mazda 626. Remember the Mazda 626? So that was from 83 or 84. You had 25 years to that. And it's this guy had an antique plate on a Mazda 626. So I didn't think that was going to happen. But anyway, it happens. And here we are, the 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman station wagon. You said there were 128,000 of these.
Yes, sir.
Made.
Just of the four-door.
This one has had some care because it's been a couple of its owners really cared about it. And one ran a body shop, right? That was Frank DeSimone.
Yeah. Well, it got lucky. I mean, it had, because those are the years that really count. You know, just like they say that people establish what kind of old age they're going to have by how they treat themselves in their 30s, you know, 20s, 30s, and 40s. Well, mm-hmm. It's the same with a car. You abuse it early on, it's not going to age well. And
when you talk to these folks, did you ask them about photographs? People take photographs of their cars?
Oh, they do. They you know, these are not possessions like coffee makers. They treat cars as something completely different. They're more a buddy, a sidekick, the trusty steed.
But have you posed for a photograph with your Camry? I bet not.
Well, I have photos of my Camry.
Do you? Because you're kind of a motorhead.
Well, no,
you've owned a number of
cars,
right?
I kind of like the way the car looks.
So you took a picture of your Camry?
I did.
How many of you have taken pictures of your cars? How many out there? You've all taken pictures?
I'm looking at
the control room. Well, see, my first car was a Ford Galaxy 500 Coupe.
Oh, no, that's worth.
That was a 68.
That's worth taking a picture of.
And she was red, too. I called her Rose. And I posed next to that, but I wouldn't. I don't think I'd pose next to my car today.
How many have you given nicknames to?
Just that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just that one. Do you give nicknames to your
other cars? Other people tend to give nicknames to my cars.
Did anyone give a nickname to the 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman?
I think everybody gave a nickname.
They all had
car.
Different names for
it? Yeah. You know, okay. The Green Pickle, Godzilla.
Because it's a nice color. by the way.
The turquoise was beautiful. It was a really deep teal, actually. It was called Highland Green, is what Chevy called it.
Very nice. And a two-tone with a roof.
The accent color was a really light kind of celery green. It was called Surf Green. And from a distance, it looks like it looks white, but it really...
That's nice.
Yeah, it was minty.
You know, I so appreciate people who take care of classic cars and polish them up and keep them great and take them out on the road. They really catch your eye. You know, here we are in the 1980s in your story, and that's a pretty boring time and kind of a bad time for American automobiles.
From the worst.
From like mid-70s to mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can understand why Mary Elizabeth Byram Ricketts, why this car would have caught her eye. She became the sixth owner of your car.
She did. And Mary Ricketts was somebody who appreciated 50s style long before it became kind of a kitschy fashion.
Mm-hmm.
She wore, cat eye glasses, flamingo earrings. This is years and years before anyone else did.
That's my kind of woman.
And she just loved this car. She bought it. She held on to it for 8 years. But now we see, we hear an ominous bass chord on the car's soundtrack because Mary Ricketts is flat broke. She's working for very little money at this nursery with Debbie Savage. And she knows nothing about machinery. So she is completely without any business owning an antique car. And she owns it for 8 years, and on her watch, the car begins a slow and tragic accelerating slide.
Okay. She couldn't take care of it, couldn't afford to take care of it?
Could not. Loved it probably more than anyone to that point had, but did not have the wherewithal to see to its upkeep, and the car responded in kind. It fell apart.
You said she had it for about 8 years?
Yes.
And then she sold it. My notes show here, is this correct, $700 in 1994?
Yes, to a gay couple, a physician, Dr. Alan Wilson, and his partner, Al Seeley, who ran an interior design business. And now, for the first time, the car is held by people who do not need it as a daily driver. Now the car becomes weekend accessory. They were members of an antique car club. They have been looking for a while for a car of their own. And this seemed to, the price was right. It continued to make a statement, even though now it was on its on decline. The car was now rusted through in a few places on the body. The paint was fading. The interior was thrashed. The engine definitely needed work. And most dramatically, the floorboards were rotting to nothing. And you could feel give beneath the carpeting when you got into this thing.
Okay, so it's Alan Wilson and Al Seeley, but they had some problems.
They did.
Right?
Well, Dr. Wilson wound up in a bit of a legal snafu that prompted him to have to resign his position at a hospital in Norfolk. They were in Norfolk, by the way. So the car is still in Hampton Roads, and it became an unnecessary expense. So they abandoned it. They walked away. They left it at the parking lot of a dealership that was owned by a friend of theirs, and just walked away from it. And they realized that they had so much on their plate that. You know.
Earl, how did the car end up in the hands of Jack's Classic Pawn?
Well, eventually the dealership owner said, "I want this car out of here," and so he had one of his people talk to the doctor, and they arranged for the car to get towed to this pawn shop, and
it goes to Jack's Classic Pawn. They get $200 for it.
Yeah,
right. And this is a pawn shop halfway between the Norfolk Naval Base and Little Creek Naval Amphibious Base.
Right.
Okay.
Good place to have a pawn shop.
So did someone from the Navy pick it up?
A Navy petty officer named Jeff Simmons was driving. Driving down Tidewater Drive in Norfolk the next day, the day after it showed up at Jack's Classic Pawn, saw the car and knew he had to have it.
So Jeffrey Simmons, now I have him as owner number 9. Does that sound about right to you?
Owner number 10, I believe.
Over 10, okay.
9 would be Jack's Classic Pawn.
Okay. And then we get to Dave Simon. Now, how does it go from Jeffrey Simons to Dave Simon?
Well, Jeffrey Simmons owns it for a couple of years. And
Simmons or Simons?
Simmons.
Simmons. I'm sorry.
He
to
is,
Dave Simon. Simmons to Simon.
Right.
Okay.
He has, as every owner has until this point, grand visions of what this car will look like restored, really wants to fix it up, parks it in his front yard, where the city slaps a notice on it, telling him that he's got a derelict vehicle on the premises, and he either has to tow it away or license it. So just as he's struggling with this, Dave Simon shows up, having made a wrong turn off Tidewater Drive on his way to a cheesesteak place, looking to turn around, pulls into Jeff Simmons' cul-de-sac, and there's this amazing car. And Dave Simon is a car maniac who has owned 284 57 Chevys to that time.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was he? Would he just restore them and sell them?
Most of them. Well, no, most of them he bought for parts, and then he'd sell what was ever what he hadn't used. You know, so, but he had gone through 284 57 Chevys. His son was due to graduate from high school in a year, so I figured he'd buy the kid a car for his graduation. And what better car than the car that he himself was completely obsessed with? So I got him a 57 Chevy wagon, bought it from Jeff Simmons for $900.
But it wasn't in great shape.
It was, in
fact. It was taking on water, right?
It was taking on all sorts of problems. In fact, the brakes went out as Dave drove it home, and he had to crash it through the backyard fence to and into a van parked in his backyard to stop it.
Wow. So how long did the Simons keep it?
Simons kept it, Dave Simon's son, Chris, kept it for 7-8 years, during which time, again, he had grand visions for future, but had no money with which to make the repairs.
I see.
So now the car became essentially undrivable.
And that's how we go full circle here. We come back to Dave Marcinsuk.
Who's
Marcinsuk?
Marcinsuk.
Marcinsuk, who is the man you first met on this story.
Who's on his rounds on the back of a garbage truck and sees the car parked on the side of the road, makes inquiries, and buys it.
He's a born-again Christian garbage man.
He is, for the city of Norfolk.
And who likes to work on cars and use the cars for parts. And
he is a mechanical savant. The guy can fix anything. If a wrench is involved in the undertaking, he's going to be able to do it.
Now I note here that during this time, after the year 2004 or so, the block of the 57 Chevy's engine cracks. That sounds serious.
Well, the car is now on its, let me think about this. The car was originally equipped with a 283 two-barrel, the classic small blocks Chevy engine. It had its original engine until Pikett Savage's ownership, at which point he overheated the car and the engine blew up, and he replaced it with a 327 that he dropped in. So now when Dave gets it, he takes out the 327, and drops in another 283. That 283 cracks, the block cracks. While he's sending off this new engine that he had just bought, this defective engine, and awaiting its replacement, he buys another car that excites him more, which is a 55 wagon. And so he eventually gives the 57 wagon away as a parts car when he sells the 55. And now this wagon, our focus, has reached that critical juncture where cars cease to be entities in their own right and become organ donors for other vehicles.
Yeah.
It's not looking good.
Is this when the birds make a nest?
Yes. At this point, one of the things Dave strips the car of is its transmission, and to hold the back of the engine up so that it won't drag on the ground, he loops a chain through holes that he punches in the floor. He breaks a window in the process, and now birds get into the car. Rain gets into the car. The birds nest in two giant holes in the front seats. The thing just goes straight to hell.
It sounds desperate. It sounds worse than purgatory. It sounds like this car, the car that you've wrote about here, Earl, is on the way out.
It's a complete beater. It's a goner. I mean, if you were to see this car in 2009, you'd say there was nothing left to salvage, let alone save.
Well, without giving the whole thing away here, because, you want people to read the book. But anyway, how does it go from that stage to where it is now, I've seen a photograph of it today in 2014, and it's an extraordinary. So how was it saved?
It fell into the hands of a guy named Tommy Arney, who owned a what some would call a junkyard, but he prefers to call a classic car lot in Moyock, North Carolina, which is about half a mile south of the Virginia line. And Tommy is a felon. He's been arrested 70-some-odd times. He's a fifth-grade dropout. He's the former owner of go-go bars and, assorted businesses, who among the businesses he owns in 2010 is this car lot. And he decides, having found out that the provenance of the car is established, a rarity, decides, hey, I'm going to fix up this car. I'm going to save this car. I'm going to preserve the memories of the people who have shared it. You know, this car carries DNA in its steel. And for a fifth grade dropout, he's a pretty thoughtful guy.
Yeah.
And sees cars in representing more than the average guy does, I think.
Does he want to restore it to its historic best?
Not necessarily. He just wants to keep it on the road. I think Tommy is somebody who views a car as something that ought to be driven. It's a machine of interchangeable parts that should, at the least, be able to take you from point A to point B. So he is not one to restore a car to museum quality and then just have it sit. It's not a car at that point.
Right.
You know, it's an exhibit.
Earl, how much of the car is original today?
You know, that's
I mean, most of the body original?
I'd say most of the body is, most of the body is correct. You know, the body from the windshield back is mostly original. The fenders are replacements from another 57. The hood, I believe, is a replacement from another 57. Floorboards are new. Interior is new. Glass is new.
It doesn't take on water anymore?
It doesn't. It's better now than it was in 1957. You know, that the paint alone will ensure that this car today will see its 100th birthday if nothing drastic happens.
So Tommy Arney, really the savior there. He's the outlaw motorhead referred to in your subtitle.
And by far the main human character of the story.
Yeah,
he owns the car.
We
the
actually didn't
opens.
Spend that much time in this hour talking about Tommy because the backstory is so interesting. But Tommy really is the dominant figure in this story.
Yeah,
right?
He's the same age as the car. He came up at the same time, so I was able to tell his story and the car story kind of in parallel until they fuse two-thirds of the way through the book.
Have you ridden in the car? Have you taken a drive in it?
Back when Dave Marson took owned it, yes. But since it's Salvation, no.
Yeah. And then there's one other name here. Al, is it Godsey?
Al Godsey, yes.
G-O-D-S-E-Y.
Yes.
He is the present owner.
He is. He's a friend and employee of Tommy's, who is now the current owner.
Well, this is a great story. And there's so much more detail in Earl Swift's book, Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream, the story of a 57 Chevy Bel Air Townsman station wagon that came off the assembly line in Baltimore and still lives today. It's in Virginia still?
Yep, it's in Chesapeake. And it has never moved more than 25 miles away from Colonial Chevrolet.
I was going to say, that's amazing. Colonial Chevrolet, that's where it was purchased in 57 by Mr. Thornhill way back when. And aside from, maybe a trip to North Carolina briefly?
Yeah, to take kids to college.
Yeah.
It's always stayed in town.
That's great. Earl Swift, the author of this book, is going to be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library tonight, 6:30 p.m., to talk about Autobiography, his book, and signed copies, I guess?
Yes, sir.
That's what you do with these things, right?
Yeah. Give some reading.
Nice to have you with us, Earl. It's nice to meet you.
What a pleasure.
Yeah, congratulations, too, on a great idea and the execution of a terrific story here.
Well,
I'd like to take a ride in that car. You should take it on tour with your book.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll take the Camry, thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Earl.
Appreciate it.
Nice to have you on the show, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. We'll be back in 22 hours and do this again. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great afternoon.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Associate Producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.